All right. Well, thank you very much. This is my first time at Anacapa. I'm glad to have a diverse audience because I think my talk is quite interdisciplinary. I hate to use that word because it's kind of cliché, but it is. I hope it is. And maybe I can get some good feedback, so feel free to interrupt me anytime. Basically, I'm interested in solving any sort of time domain problems. I like time domain problems. I like the action, wavelets in action. I'm right now working on electromagnetic pulses propagating, hitting different materials, seeing what happens, especially in the realm of nanotechnology. Okay, so I'm looking at the nanometer scale. A lot of interesting things happen. That's one thing. And then I'm interested in propagating quantum wave packets non-relativistically using just time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Okay? And that can be very tricky, as obviously, as you know, you increase degrees of freedom. And I use a wavelet basis set. That's the big thing. I've collaborated Erwin Goldberg. He's an engineer, actually, at St. Mary's. And he's interested in using this stuff for some of his engineering things, like propagating pulses through metals and things like that. And then I had Eva Nawara. She's just recently graduated. She was an undergrad student of mine, and she did a little bit with me. And she is now going to a PhD program in electrical engineering, in computational electrical engineering. So she's very excited. Amber Brown and Brian Stratton, these are two undergrad students that I had. Just like Allison and Courtney both went from one school to another, I also did the same. I had a similar kind of route. I was at a very small school for a while, and I was a department of one. It was me. It was a single body problem. It was quite interesting. I learned a lot of things. I learned a lot about politics, administration. I learned all that good stuff in my first time teaching. But unfortunately, my research suffered tremendously from that because I just kept getting pulled in all sorts of different directions. And so I wanted to do more research. I moved to another school, and in the school, they've kind of given me more opportunities to do that. And so after 4 years at this previous college, I'm slowly getting back into the game. It's been tough, but I think I can do it. We'll see what happens. But these are two undergrads that I had at Greenville College. They're very good. She's in medical school. He's an engineer. So, you know. Bruce Johnson, he's the wavelet guru. He's the one that I go to when I have a problem. I did a postdoc with him at Rice University, and he's more of a chemist, a computational chemist, but, you know, honestly, I don't know the difference between some AMO stuff and computational chemistry. They're just almost identical. So there's a very fine line that divides those. So anyways, start off, I get all my science from sci-fi movies. No, I don't, not really. And I was dragged to see this movie. I was so dizzy afterwards. But there was this interesting quote that I saw in this movie, and I was like, let me get into, I guess, character here. So Maggie is a computer hacker, okay? And here's, obviously, he's an admiral, big up. And let's see here. So this is a very tense situation. So think of tense, okay? Sir, they hacked your firewall in 10 seconds. Even a supercomputer with a brute force attack would take 10 years to do that. Maybe you can explain why our enemies are doubling their armed forces. Maybe it's a precaution because it isn't that what we're doing. The signal pattern is learning. It's evolving on its own. And you need to move past Fourier transforms and start thinking quantum mechanics. There's nothing on Earth that complex. Now, Fred, can you enlighten us what this exactly means? Just kidding. Okay, that's, there we go, thank you. So, I was watching this movie. Unfortunately, I got there late. It was on an IMAX. I was sitting in the very front. I was just like, things were moving. I was getting really nauseous. And I heard that, and I was thinking, what in the world just happened? So I had to look the quote up. I heard Fourier transforms, I heard quantum mechanics. I was kind of intrigued. I was like, how does that play into this? Actually, this makes zero sense. I mean, we use Fourier transforms and quantum mechanics. I don't know what they're thinking. They had a very bad consulting, or they just wanted to throw in some terms. But anyways, if I were a consultant, I would say, we need to move past Fourier transforms and start thinking about wavelet transforms. That would be my bias, but anyways, they didn't consult me, of course. So anyways, I'm going to talk about wavelets just for a while. What are they? Okay. Why are they useful? What are they typically used for? And what do I want to use them for? So those are kind of the questions that I would like to answer. And so they're L2 functions, and they have really cool mathematical properties conducive to their use in representing data, okay? For example, like IR spectroscopy data, seismic data, a lot of times in the grayscale information per pixel of an image, okay? So in imaging, image analysis and all that stuff. Or other functions. I like other functions like wave packets or electromagnetic wave pulses. Those are kind of my things, okay? So in general, I want to use them to solve PDEs, okay, that come up in physics. Ingrid Dobeshes, and she is a, she's really big, probably I think her name is most associated with wavelets because she developed these Dobeshes wavelets, which are the ones that I use, very useful. And she wrote a little piece in a IEEE, Proceedings of the IEEE. So engineers, they like these things too. And she kind of gave some big names, and I just wanted to mention some of them. First of all, you can't, when you talk about wavelets, obviously you cannot not mention Fourier. You know, we knew that we could represent functions with sines and cosines. That was Fourier, okay, back in 1800s. And then as far as who started the whole wavelet idea, some people claim there's a guy named Haar. You might have heard of Haar wavelets back in the early 1900s. And basically they're step functions, there's little step functions, and you can vary the scales and all that stuff, and you can represent things with that as well. But I would say most literature, they say the guy who started it all was a geophysicist, Jean Morlet, okay? And he was interested in, he had some seismic data. I guess he wanted to look at the different scales and break it up or actually store it. And he had problems with sines and cosines. Didn't work too well. Okay, so him and he had this idea. He kind of combined efforts with a theoretical physicist named Alex Grossman, who was very big and he knew a lot about coherent states. And I think they collaborated and they were able to kind of start the early work on wavelets and formalizing it and all that. Yves Meyer received some of that that information. He developed some Meyer wavelets, which are very common. Okay, so you might have heard that in the literature. And then Le Marier, all right, was a student of Meyer, and independently a guy, I guess it's Guy Battel, I don't know how you pronounce that in French, but anyways, there was these Le Marier Battel wavelets. They were big. Okay, so these guys started doing that, and then it kind of went in this direction. This guy, Stéphane Mallat, he was kind of the computer scientist who realized that they could be used in image analysis and things like that. And today, they're used in JPEG files. I don't know what kinds, but there are. And he kind of started that trend. And then, but really, a student of Alex Grossman was Ingrid Dobeshes. And those are she started these Dobeshes wavelets, which really are nice, and these are the ones that we use. And I think they're the most commonly used when solving PDEs, the Dobeshes wavelets. Okay, so that's just kind of a little history of wavelets, very brief. Here's just some examples. This is a Morlet wavelet, Haar step, just a step function. Okay, it's actually just one and then it's zero. Just one in that little region. This is the Shannon wavelet. This is the Mexican hat wavelet. I have no idea. Why don't they just call it like a sombrero wavelet? I don't know, but who knows? Maybe there's a difference, and maybe there's a history behind it. Here's just a kind of a crude example I show this to my undergrads. Here's an interesting function, and it's got lots of, or it's very kind of smooth, and then it, as you get closer and closer, it gets more and more and more fancy wiggles and details. And if I were to represent this in one scale of Haar wavelet step functions, and this is a very, obviously you wouldn't want to do it this crude, but you can see that at one scale, you can capture, you know, this coarse area quite nicely, obviously, but when you get towards the more detail, you're going to need some finer scales to capture that more accurately. But it's just a crude example. When I say using functions to represent functions, a lot of my students are like, what? They just, I lose them, so I just have to draw a picture. Okay, so why are they useful? They're L2, they're localized as opposed to sines and cosines. Okay, so maybe with this localization, it can help you pick up details, okay, that maybe you otherwise could not. All right. There's this really interesting, well, they're very patriarchal. You start with a father function, and then from there, you can dilate and translate, and you can create all the other wavelets in your basis from that. Okay. And the big thing, and I'll talk a lot about this, is its multi-resolution capability. You can effectively capture different varying levels of detail. Okay, so if you have a wave packet coming in, it's very smooth, and then it hits a barrier and all these wiggles happen, how can you represent that efficiently? Okay. This is not a always a property of wavelets, but for our purposes, this is very important. Orthogonality really helps you find function representations. One thing that we're finding, and this is kind of more recent, is that they're really good when you have, when you're trying to map out curving situations, maybe like a, for example, in my case, I might have a pulse hitting some sort of curved material interface. With grid points, it's a little troubling because they're grid points and everything's rectangular. With these, we're finding that there may be some benefit with that. And then, you know, they can be easily extended to multidimensional systems, although, of course, computation goes up. I'm hoping one of the things I want to answer is there a way, does wavelets allow the scale or allow the scaling of computation to be not so bad as with other traditional methods? That's kind of one of the questions. Here's an example, a really common example of what wavelets are used for. Okay, they're used for obviously many things. Okay, so I heard this quote in a couple talks. You know, if all you had is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, kind of like that thing. It's similar, that kind of thing happened with wavelets, and I'm trying not to fall in that trap because, you know, I've got this new exciting tool and I just want to bang everything with it. I know it's, you know, not good for some things, you know, probably great for others. I'm still trying to find that niche. It's been a long, you know, it's been an interesting journey. Okay, I've learned a lot of things in the process. But yeah, you can fall into that trap quite easily with wavelets, and they did for a while, and back when they first came out in the 80s and things. But anyway, so storing data, image, you know, how much bytes per image, that's a big thing. So especially in FBI, they've got all these fingerprints of, you know, very naughty people, right? Probably on there too, I don't know. One of us is on there, right? No, I don't know. But anyway, so if you have a typical fingerprint is about 0.6, you know, megabytes. Of course, you have 10 fingers. Most of us do. So that would be about 6 megabytes of data. And imagine you have hundreds of millions of these, okay? When you're getting to the petabyte scale, which I guess is not so bad anymore. In the high energy group, I've heard that they're using petabytes. But seems big to me. Anyways, what wavelets offer is a way to store things, and you can see this is with a wavelet basis set. You can store this with an order of magnitude, or more than an order of magnitude reduction in storage. And the important thing is when you're doing fingerprints, you want to make sure that you have a scale that captures accurately, these are called the black flesh islands. Okay, those are real important on fingerprints to identify somebody. And also these little white things, They're called pores. These are sweat pores. Okay, those are some identifying things, and you want to make sure with wavelets you can efficiently capture a certain scale that you want that may get these identifying factors to a point where you can identify easily, and then you can, of course, they're more efficiently, so you can reduce the amount of storage by order of magnitude. So that's one really big use of wavelets. But what do I want to use them for? I like them as a hammer to hit everything. No, I'm just kidding. I don't want to do that. But here's some things that I'm interested in. For my first kind of journey in physics, I did a lot of kind of more problems that chemists were interested in. They were interested in, calculating the energy spectra of small molecules, okay, 2, 3, 4, 5 atoms, and these were floppy. They had large amplitude of vibrations and definitely not harmonic whatsoever. Okay, this correlates to very large matrices, extremely large. And I spent my PhD working on that with not just wavelets. I'd used other types of functions and things. That's one. Clusters are a big thing. I don't know if you've heard of clusters. They're usually composed of somewhere between, you can start with 2 to about 1,000. It can be either atoms or molecules that are weakly bound, usually by van der Waals or hydrogen bonding, very weakly bound. Okay, so they're really, there's not very much harmonic motion. These are really interesting because they can do these in experimentally. They can address the number of atoms within the cluster, and they can explore first order phase transitions. Like, what is melting when you really get down to maybe, let's say, 100 atoms? What does it look like? Actually, when you see something melting, there's really a range of temperature when it starts to melt. It's not just one temperature. It's really weird. It kind of hops back and forth. But you can study that kind of stuff with clusters. Other few body quantum systems, in the dynamics side of thing, chemists are real interested in, molecular interactions, things like photodissociation of molecules, vibrational predissociation, that's a big word they always talk about. Quantum dots, something Tian talked about, that is something that I was looking at. You can solve interesting diagonalized Hamiltonians of these. And then, of course, Allison's kind of stuck up an interest in me with her atomic collisions. I'm kind of interested in maybe seeing where if they could be a use in that. But currently, I'm using them right now for propagating pulses in Maxwell's equations, and in particular, looking. This is a very big field in the nanotechnology world, okay, because they're able to create, metals and spheres of, 5 nanometers large, smaller than the wavelength of the light that hits it, and some pretty cool things happen. You have this, if you hit a metal, there's this thing called the surface plasmon resonance. The electrons, the conduction electrons start oscillating, and then they heat up, and there's lots of applications to that. In fact, they even started doing human trials on these gold nanoshells where they inject them into somebody who has a tumor more on the surface, okay? And these nanoshells, because the blood vessels are somewhat porous, okay, on tumors, because you got angiogenesis and those blood vessels growing very fast, those nanoshells can collect in the tumor, whereas they wouldn't collect in the healthier tissue, because the healthier tissue, the blood vessels are not as porous. And then you can shine a very harmless infrared, visible, kind of in that range light, and those things will start heating up because of the surface plasmon resonance, and then it'll kill the tumor. Actually, doing this with human trials, they've done it successfully with rabbits and rats and things, taking them away from their parents. It's been very sad. But anyways, they're doing that. And so there's lots of applications, and I'm, of course, I'm starting with just basic things. And then, of course, my colleague in the engineering, he's real interested in these elastic pulse propagation equations. They're a bunch of coupled PDEs, and he wants to see if there's any. He has problems right at boundaries and things where he needs lots of detail. So those are kind of some, why, you know, what are they used for, and why are they useful, and what do I want to use them for? So those are some of the questions. Now, kind of into some of the properties, okay? In particular, there's these least asymmetric Dobeshis. Now, why did they use a double negative? I don't know. I thought about it, and I think I know why. Apparently, wavelets of this type, okay, they have compact support, so they're just non-zero within a certain region. Okay, wavelets of this type, there is a no-go theorem that says that wavelets of this type cannot be symmetrical. I don't know the math behind it. I just remember hearing about it. So these are the, and so they're very asymmetric in general, but these are the least asymmetric possible. So if you want to, and that's really not, I mean, that still looks goofy, right? It's not really symmetric, but it's the least asymmetric possible, I guess. So that's where that came from, as far as I understand. So in the wavelet basis, okay, there's two types of functions in the wavelet basis. There's the mother and the father. All right, I don't know where these terms came from. Sometimes they call them the scaling and the wave. That makes me confused because I use wavelet to call all of them that. But anyways, I like to stick to just mother and father, okay? This is a father function. The father function tends to get more of the coarse properties, more of the smooth properties of your function, and then the mother functions tend to capture detail very effectively. And you can see by the wiggles, okay? And so I call the father phi and the mother psi. There's a parameter L, and L is a, it's a number, it's an even integer, a positive integer that represents the family. Okay, you can have L equals to 2. That actually turns out to be the Haar wavelet. You can have L equals 4, 6, 8, and on and on and on. These are different families of wavelets, and the L corresponds to the compact supportness, one thing, okay? So the larger the L, the further these spread out, each wavelet function. And also, though, the larger the L, the smoother they are. This is for L equals to 8. If I showed L equals to 4, you would notice it's continuous, but very jiggity. There's no, you know, it's not continuously differentiable at all, okay? And as you increase L, they get smoother and smoother and smoother. Actually, they start representing functions a lot better, although there's at a cost. Also, what's interesting with these wavelets in particular is as that L corresponds to a term called the approximation order of the wavelets. What does that mean? That means these wavelets, which I think is fascinating, is like, let's say at L equals 8, okay, the approximation order of this is, it's L over 2 minus 1, so that would be 3. That means that this thing can 100% accurately represent a cubic polynomial, okay? Exactly. You can use them to any polynomial that's cubic, okay? The higher the L, you can start representing polynomials exactly. And that was just fascinating to me. I mean, I was just like blown away. But yeah, so that's another interesting property, okay? And another thing is this two-scale relation. And this is one of the defining properties of wavelets. There is a recursion relationship that takes you from wavelets of one scale to wavelets of a one-step coarser scale. So this is like, you could say, this is one scale, this is one step coarser. So these are half as narrow as these, okay? And you use this recursion relationship, and you just take them. These are the wavelets at p scale, and you take them, and these little numbers are called filter coefficients, okay? And you combine the filter coefficients with that, and you can create with these filter coefficients, you create this nice father function of this scale. And if you use a different set of filter coefficients, you can create the mother wavelet. This is known as a low-pass filter. This is known as a high-pass. This is, if you were in the engineering community, you would hear this. But this is interesting because you can easily, like if you're representing some function in one scale and you wanted to look at it in another scale, you can easily make this conversion from one scale to the next with a simple relationship. And these filter coefficients, when you start with wavelets, this is all you have. You just have the set of filter coefficients. And then once you have those, you can do anything. You do anything with those. So you don't have all the points. All you need are the filter coefficients. And once you have those, you can do anything you want. You've got all the information you need for the wavelets. It's really interesting. Okay? Obviously, these are not, there's no analytical representation of these. Okay? So, anyways, that kind of got me sold. And of course, you can translate them in space and you can scale them in different sizes. Okay? For J is a parameter, I call it the scaling parameter. The higher the J, so it goes JK, the higher the J, the thinner they get, the more finer. And then K is the translational parameter, so K gives you an idea of where they're positioned in space. So you've got this nice little system, okay? So here's just some examples of different father functions at different scales and different translational positions. All right? Yes? So
can you help me? Because these are not a basis, right?
They are bases.
They are a basis.
Yes, the phi and the psi make up a basis, yeah.
They make up how many? I mean, like, you're saying, because so it looks like they don't look, those don't look orthogonal, right?
They actually, so these are, actually I'll tell you which ones are orthogonal. I was going to go to the next slide, but what is orthogonal is all of the scaling, or all the father functions at one scale are orthogonal to each other, and then all the mother functions are orthogonal to the father. So there are these orthogonality, so that you can create an orthogonal basis set. There are these orthogonality relationships. Now, so for example, let me go back. Whoops, going the wrong way. These are orthogonal to each other. Okay.
Is that upper limit capital L?
Yeah, so that's the L.
Capital L. It's
capital
the same L you mentioned.
The wavelet family.
Yeah.
And so the higher the L, the larger the wavelet is and the smoother it is.
And L has to start at 2?
Yeah, 2.
Okay.
I don't know why, but actually it comes from the number of terms in this scaling relationship, actually. Yes. As L increases, they get smoother and smoother, and there's a whole analysis of how that happens. Like, you know, it'll go C1, C2, C, you know, as you increase L, the continuous differentiability gets more and more, you know, as you increase L. Yeah, but I didn't show that, like, the L equals to 2 is just a step function, actually. the L equals to 4 is still jiggity, yeah.
One, are the eigenstates of anything in, that you can think of?
Are these eigenstates? No, I mean, they're not. The main point is, can we use them to represent eigenstates efficiently? Yeah, but as far as I know, I don't know of any sort of operator that would support them or matrix. Yeah, so, yes.
Right. On that note, now, of course, one operator you might do for any partial differential equation would be derivative.
Yeah, that's a big field of research.
Yeah, so is there, so these scaling relations sort of are, these aren't derivatives.
No.
I don't know how to think about them, but are there ways of approximating the derivatives using the scaling relations that have nice things?
Oh, using these relations here?
Or some sort of relationship.
Yeah, actually, I spent Bruce Johnson and I kind of looking over his shoulder. We spent many years looking at how to best represent a derivative matrix in this basis set. And he's made some big headway. In fact, he had, and I'm not going to talk about it, it's really, and still I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I don't know how he got such accuracy with it. But he, it basically involves the moments of these functions, and then he does some weird inversion, matrix inversion, and he gets this matrix, or he gets a filter, he gets a line of a row vector of numbers, and it's almost like a finite difference, and he uses that, and he can just get these great derivatives. So basically the answer is, you can get great derivative matrices using these. I don't know why or how, why these would be better at derivatives, a lot better than grid points and finite differencing, a lot better, yeah. So it's real interesting, yeah. So I guess this is the multi-resolution. So if you had a bunch of father functions at infinite scale, so they're like almost like delta functions, okay, and they're everywhere. Obviously, that's a complete basis, okay, but we can't do that computationally. So we pick a scale, J, and we pick a range, and we try to get the best approximation that our computer allows us to represent some function. But what's interesting with wavelets is that this single scale is equal to a set of wavelets of varying scales. It's equal to, okay? Meaning that this single scale can be represented as a set of functions that are of father functions that are at a very coarse scale. So this J naught is very large, okay? Or sorry, I'm very small. Small J means very coarse. Plus a bunch of mother functions, these are ones that capture all the detail, at different scales, okay? So basically we have a multi-resolution expansion. You've got one scale here, but then many scales of the mother functions. This is equivalent to this. And this is really nice because what it turns out is these coefficients tend to be really close to zero, and you can throw them a lot of them out. And what happens is you start getting a very efficient representation of your function with this multi. So you may have a function like that Doppler function, has lots of little scales over here, very broad over here. Well, you can throw out a lot of the real fine ones over here, but keep them over here where you need it. Can't do that with grid points. I mean, there's some hand waving, some people can do some weird tricks, but really can't. It's not as natural in grid points as it is with wavelets, okay?
Have you told us how to pick J0?
So actually what happens is you pick a J, it's right now, I don't know if there's any sort of algorithm to pick the best J0, yeah. Right now, maybe later, we work on them, right? Maybe there will be, but right now, no. And then since they're all orthogonal, so these are orthogonal to these are orthogonal with each other, these are orthogonal with each other, okay, then you can find those coefficients quite easily. Yes?
So just on your point to where you say in various regions you can reduce the size of the basis.
Yeah, where we do the yeah.
So I presume that there must be some sort of condition to link,
yeah. So
different regions, right?
Well, what I was just saying is you could find out in some. Well, what happens is you could have a cutoff of, like, if a B function is below some value, you can throw it out because it's not going to contribute much to your function in a certain position or something like that. And so in the end, you'd have this nice efficient. I'm going to do a little demonstration of it, actually. So I have this. This is some, I mean, I show this to undergrads. Actually, I made a big glaring mistake. I'm going to admit it now. I don't admit it to undergrads because they don't notice it. But if I were to propagate a pulse to hit some sort of interface, like this is a vacuum, this is something, and then you get a transmitted and a reflected, this amplitude should not be that high. I don't know how that happened. It was my mistake. I did not create energy out of nothing. I just want to point that out. I noticed this a while back, and I was too lazy to change it. Anyways, so here's an example. So let's say I want to track the dynamics of this function, okay, and I'm not going to do it dynamically, I just want to, let's take a snapshot at this point here when you've got these two waves. I could be very lazy and say, I can represent this with 170 father functions at some scale. Now, that's overdoing it, and yeah, definitely overkill. But what if I instead, choosing a single scale, what if I decided to do it in many different scales? So let's do that. So first I start off with father functions at j equals 1. That's a lot coarser. And I recreate it, and I get something that looks like this. Okay, so I notice I'm getting some of the picture. And then I add in mother functions at j equals 1. I add those in, and I get, once I add these and these, I get this. And I'm starting to notice that right away, I'm getting what I need. And so here, I use 16 here, and I use 16 here. So right now, I'm at a total, to get this, of 32 functions. Okay? And then, I go to a higher scale of mother functions, and it adds this contribution, and it cleans it up a little bit, actually. So now I'm at, how many is that? 19, 32, that's 51. 51. And then I noticed that that's weird. That's not supposed to be dipping too much, so maybe there's some more detail. And I throw in j equals to 3, these, and that cleans it up right away. In the end, I've only used 66 functions versus 170. So using the multi-resolution, I've reduced the number of functions that I need to represent this within a certain level of accuracy that I want. Yeah. So that's kind of one advantage. So instead of, usually with a basis set you have one scale, instead of using 170 with wavelets, which you now can venture into multiple scales, you can do it with 66 at that level of accuracy. So there's that kind of benefit. Yes?
So just if maybe there is no hand-waving argument for the properties that you've shown before and then how they show up here. It looks like, you know, you've got one region that would naturally be represented using functions of one frequency or one wavelength. And here you have this other region where you've got, you know, this different one.
Yeah.
And so do the choices of how, you know, sort of you take a path through the wavelet functions, is it because that you're scaling and shifting that you can actually do that sort of in this common language?
Yeah, you can. So, right. So, yeah, scaling and shifting, and that's an interesting point because you notice this doesn't have as much level of detail as this. And so really, this actually, at this point, this is done. And then over here, this still needs to be worked on. So you have to go to a higher scale. Is there a set algorithm? I mean, the only thing I can think of right now is you just look at the coefficients. If they're below a cutoff, and you throw them out. That's the only, I mean, there may be other analyses. I'm not sure. That's kind of what we're looking at right now, just kind of a brute force. Yes.
So is there any kind of measure that would let you anticipate in advance, given a signal, how much better you can do?
Oh, then, yeah.
If I just give it a signal before I actually put the wavelets in, just to estimate, you know, I'm going to get a factor, like here it's a factor of 3 better.
No, that I don't know. That, as far as, like, you know right away what sort of improvements you're going to get, it depends upon, you know, is your function have varying degrees of detail with and how that is distributed? I don't know if there's
an entropic measure that, you know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Paula Shannon or something.
Maybe somebody has done that, but we sure have not. Yeah. That would be really a nice study, though. I don't know how you would do that.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah.
I certainly don't know.
We're still, I mean, there's mathematicians that, when we look up their papers, they have their own language, and it's very frustrating, but sometimes you got to do it. But that's kind of an example of multi-resolution. And so I just want to say that, you know, we solve this, we solve Maxwell's equations. What's interesting is that they're very closely connected. In fact, you can rewrite Maxwell's equations that look somewhat like Schrodinger equation, you know, just by putting E and H field like in a column vector. And then you've got, this is kind of like an operation. And so it looks like, so we do both. We go back and forth. We're like, oh, let's use this for quantum, let's use this for electromagnetic pulse. We go back and forth. Although there's different challenges. You know, in quantum mechanics, your degrees of freedom can go up to whatever. I mean, go up as high as you want it. Whereas in Maxwell's, you only have 3 degrees of freedom, but you've got weird geometries and discontinuities and things like that, because you always have material interfaces. And so there's challenges that are different in both. I'm right now focusing on this, although I want to move back into the quantum. I kind of hop back and forth, classical quantum, I don't know, whatever I feel like that day. But right now I'm working on how to handle basically interfaces. And I'm almost out of time. Well, I am out of time, but I just wanted to say that... Oh, okay. I usually, when I have undergrads, I tell them, okay, if I want to represent a function in a wavelet basis, how do I do that in a computer? Well, you know, I basically represent, if in the wavelet, this is at a single scale, I find these coefficients, okay, by integrating, and we do quadrature methods, all sorts of nice, fancy quadrature methods. And we can represent this function approximately as a column vector, as an array. That's kind of how I tell them. And then, you know, I'm like, well, what about an operator? We've got an operator you have to deal with. It's just like taking an expectation value. I mean, except that you don't necessarily have the same wavelet on each side in the sandwich. And so I tell them about that. You get a nice matrix representation. And so you can approximately represent any sort of operator mapping by a matrix vector product. You know, depending upon how many functions you have and what scale, you can improve that better and better. And so in the 1D case, because of the compact supportness, your operator matrices are this band diagonal. That's really nice. And so that's great. 1D, you know, as you make your basis bigger, it doesn't grow like a square and squared. It just grows linearly. That's great. But the problem, when you go to higher degrees of freedom and you want to represent a system, you have to use a direct product basis set. And when you use any type of direct product basis set, it doesn't matter if it's wavelets or anything else, the computational effort scales exponentially as you add a degree of freedom. And that's a big problem. And that's the problem that we're trying to figure out. I mean, that's why we can only do 4 or 5 body scattering, or we can only calculate energy eigenvalues of molecules of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 degrees of freedom. So that's the big problem. Now, are wavelets the answer? I don't know. I'm hoping maybe the answer is something similar. So I'm kind of optimistic with caution. I don't know if they're the answer, but they definitely do have some interesting benefits. So, you know, if you have this exponential scaling, obviously any sort of diagonalization is out of the question, especially if these are dense, okay, if the matrices don't have a lot of zero elements. Now, we do have a lot of sparsity with wavelets, and that's a great thing. Sparsity is wonderful, obviously. And this is an example at 2 degrees of freedom. This is what the matrix would look like. It's like fractal almost, if you think about it. Let me go back. Whoops. So here's like a cell within a bunch of... So these are all the white space are zeros. These are all non-zero elements. These are all zeros. I put zeros here. But anyways, it's banded. And each cell is banded, so it's fractal, and it's really interesting. But, you know, this, and if you start, this is just a single scale. When you start adding other scales, it gets really messy, okay? And so, yes, there are advantages, but they're really hard to code. And so that's kind of one of the challenges that I've been hitting. What's interesting, though, is for wavelets, I don't. Okay. So all I know is MATLAB and Mathematica have some packages with wavelets, and as, at this level, I don't. When I looked at them, it was not at basically dealing with these higher degrees of freedom like this. Yeah, it wasn't. They're not prepared. They weren't for that. Yeah, one or a picture. You give you a picture. Basically, that's what they were mainly for. But this stuff, no. Yeah, because they don't solve PDEs with those packages, or PDEs that we want to solve, obviously. But what was interesting is we worked on a type of wavelet that actually, let's say you had a potential matrix, that actually the potential matrix is very diagonal, meaning that all the other elements are basically zero. That's great. If you just have a diagonal matrix representation of your potential, that's the big one, representing your potential, because your potential could be anything. But if you can do a diagonal, it actually not only is it sparse, obviously, a diagonal matrix is very sparse, but you can handle all these different scales really nicely just along a diagonal element. So that was one thing that we were able to do and had some success in. And I had a student work on just doing a simple problem, just propagating a ground state of a harmonic displaced harmonic oscillator, just going back and forth with the wavelet basis, and she was able to do that. And she compared, you know, the number of non-zero matrix elements in simlets in one type of wavelets versus these new ones, and you can definitely see there's an advantage. There's a huge advantage. These are different scales, but you can see that the number of non-zero elements definitely a lot smaller, and you can get similar results, basically. So that was something, and she learned a lot from that. Now she's in med school, so I guess I scared her away. I tend to do that. This stuff is not for the, I don't know. I spent a lot of time, and I wrote like this tutorial of wavelets, just pencil and paper. I need to probably make it nice and pretty with pictures. And I give it to students when they're interested. They're like, oh, cool, wavelets. I don't know what they are, but it sounds cool. They come in and they read it, and a lot of them are like, I don't know. And I'm just like, really? I thought I broke it down nicely, but I guess I didn't. So I'm having a real hard problem. So I've kind of branched out to other things for students, because this doesn't seem to be the most palatable for students. But some things, I'm investigating the advantages of these wavelets with grid points. There's two methods that are really popular with grid point methods in dynamics. This stands for finite difference time domain, FDTD. Basically, you represent your spatial and time derivatives in a finite difference approximation. And then they do this in electromagnetic calculations, and they've had great success, and they can somewhat parallelize it, and they do a lot of calculations. But they're very expensive, and I'm just trying to see if there's a way to reduce that. This is not PTSD, but PSTD is pseudo-spectral time domain. And so that's basically, it's a grid point method as well, but when you handle derivatives, derivative matrices, you just do fast Fourier transform. It makes calculating the derivative a lot easier. But you know, there's advantages with wavelets, no staircasing, multi-resolution. You can get better accuracy with not as fine a scaling as with grid points. But the disadvantage is there's really challenging to code, and there's also a Gibbs phenomenon, just like with four. And I've been working on that. We actually figured out a way, Bruce Johnson and I, to deal with that. So hopefully, Journal of Computational Physics will accept it. They seem to be sitting on it for a while. I guess I don't know. I've been working on. How to handle that when you're dynamically propagating something, how to handle some sort of interface. And I found a method to do it from an old, well, not that old, 1998 paper. And it was using calculating these. In this paper, they were calculating something called fictitious points. And these fictitious points gave you these information on the boundary conditions. And then I won't go into the details. It's real technical. But anyways, I was able to extend it to wavelets. And that's what I'm working on right now. And the problem I'm dealing with is a 2D problem. And it's basically all it is if I have a pulse hitting it's a 2D problem because I have a long, infinitely long cylinder. And I have a pulse that hits a cylinder, silver, and you model the silver. A lot of you condensed matter people might know about this. You model the silver with a Drude model, which is dependent on frequency. And so I'm working on this one right now, kind of making some headway with wavelets, but that's the one thing. So, thank you very much.
So what about cloaking?
Cloaking? Like looking at those...
So you've got... What I've seen, I guess, so far is you had the EM propagation where you had changing permeability.
Yeah, permittivity, yeah,
permittivity,
it's changing,
but
yeah.
Either you have both or you have some interesting profiles.
What do they call those
metamaterials.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's right. And so you can have certain strange regions, but you can, cloak. So far in microwave, I heard something was
this. This is an interesting because you have to have to do these metamaterials. You have to have certain it's almost like lattices of things, and so that might be a great application. And that's actually something that Bruce Johnson was talking about that may be an advantage. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, most of the models seem to have some sort of... Well, no, that's right. The split ring resonators have those weird structures. But some of the theoretical modeling, it would look like they were just choosing smooth epsilons and mus, but there's no need for them to be smooth per se, and so maybe there's...
Now, this is my question. I mean, we treat... In general, we treat them as discontinuous, but a lot of... I hear that's in real life, they're really not. They're somewhat smooth. I don't know. When you get to the microscopic level. So I'm like, well, then why are we doing this discontinuously? Because it makes it so much more difficult for me. But I don't know. Yeah, that's still something I'm learning about. Yes.
Another problem that is of sort of a similar kind of metamaterial, but this time I think it's inspired by atom chips, where you have sort of atom waveguides that go down like this and then bend.
Okay.
And evidently you get bound states at corners and junctions that are sort of they sort of come out at a different scale than the more natural scale of the waveguide, right? And so when you start talking about how this can be a multi-scale process, mm-hmm. it seems like that might be an interesting one too. I could probably find some references.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I'm definitely looking for
because that's what I just think it's so neat, right? You just get these bound states at these sort of topological or geometrical, yeah.
Certain regions, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. Oh, well. Yes.
I'm curious, do you use any of this in teaching, for example, quantum mechanics for visualizing?
I do not. My hope is...
I mean,
you're right.
That I have a book and software that I think... Davidson Group, or that called Quantum Physics with...
With wavelets?
Wavelets?
Really?
That's with applets? I mean, I was thinking you can build up the...
This is my thought.
Wave function propagates in time.
This is great. That's why I wrote a tutorial, because what I found out is that if I can get a motivated student that has some courage, because it is a rather large learning curve, you can actually see a lot of things in play. You can do some simple quantum, and you learn your linear algebra really well with this. And I try to write it in this tutorial in this way. And I've had one student actually went through it all, and she still kept with it. But then she went to med school, so I don't know what happened. But anyways, that, I think it would be a great teaching tool for those kind of things, and I'm kind of exploring that as well. Because you've got all sorts of elements that you can put all together, and you can somewhat simplify it so where it's palatable. Yeah. Yes.
So I'll this probably is going into the dark side of non-academic.
Okay.
But you know, there's also lots of technological interest in being able to do EM modeling of circuits. And in fact, one circuit which you know just looks crazy, but they have like fractal antennas. So these are antennas.
Fractal antennas.
Yeah,
and
these
so
are
they branch off
antennas
fractally?
That have some sort of self-similar structure.
Oh.
And it's supposed to give you broad.
Like transformers, right? They're so. self. Oh.
But it's supposed to have some sort of broadband properties associated.
Oh.
With it. But it seems like if you've got something that. You know, that's another nail.
Yeah, right. That's another nail I can bang on a few times.
The interesting question would be, you know, there might actually be people who would pay money to come up with better ways of modeling those.
Hmm. So. Hey, well, that sounds good to me. Yeah. Oh, yes.
So for my own research, the bane of my existence is finding delta functions in Fourier series.
Oh, okay. Oh, you can do delta functions well in wavelets.
It's well known when you take the Fourier transform of the delta function, that gives you a 1, right?
Right.
So it's a non-convergent sequence.
Sure.
And then if you didn't know you had a delta function in your data.
Okay. Okay.
And you try to go backwards, you find that the function that's generated from partial sums doesn't converge.
Okay. Okay.
Is there, because you have the Gibbs phenomenon,
yeah.
Is there a similar phenomenon, or is there as to the delta function for the Fourier transform, or are these much better behaved?
Well, so I haven't explored that, but the Gibbs phenomenon, I can just tell you, that comes from the overlapping. So I'll give you a picture. That's right about. It comes from the fact that they overlap each other. So let's say I want to represent this function here. Okay. Well, I have to end somewhere, so the end part is going to look crazy because of, you know, it's that. And then this is going to look goofy, this derivative discontinuity. And you can make these finer and finer, and you're still going to get this goofiness, and it's not going to go down like normal things go down as far as. But there's many ways to handle this. You can, one way is they put some different wavelets here that were perfect for the edge, but that messes things up because when you go to multi dimensions, now you've got billions of different functions you've got to contend with, different types of functions. No. Another one, we found a way of doing partial wavelets, so you just partially cut them off. The problem with that is once you start cutting them off, they don't become orthogonal anymore. But we found a way to deal with that, actually. So that's one. So that's kind of the issue, is the overlappingness of the functions. They're not like finite elements, they stick in a region, and they just cover one region, and you just have a bunch of different levels of detail. And then you go to another region, you got your other set of functions. It's not like that. So that's kind of, but I don't know, I haven't dealt with that issue in what I'm studying yet. But that's all I can say about the Gibbs phenomenon with this. So, well, great. Thank you very much. Good day.